When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the charts, graphs, and Venn diagrams throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Rees.
Hey, here I am. Here we are. We're both here.
Yes.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Yes, we took our little break.
By the time this posts, it'll be well past the New Year.
Oh, it'll be 2023.
And everything will be fine.
Everything will be fine. Back to normal. Mammon will be praised or appeased. So today on the program, we will be discussing...
Or appraised.
So today on the program, we'll be discussing The Black Monday Murders by Jonathan Hickman and Tom Corker, which should be a breeze. No problem discussing this one.
No. Yeah. Nothing deep in this one.
What the hell was I thinking, Brian?
But just wait till I recommend Moonshadow.
Oh my god. Yes. No, but first, before we get into that, another economic story was going on recently in comics, and that is that the workers at Image Comics have voted to unionize. And if Billy Bragg has taught me nothing, I know that there is power in a union.
Yes.
Utah
Phillips has some thoughts on the matter as well.
Yes. Yeah. So I don't think we'll spend a lot of time on it. I don't think we'll spend a lot of time on this, but I think we're just going to give our initial thoughts. I'll let you go. Brian, how do you feel about this?
Well, I think the obnoxious sound in the background was me clapping. So good for them.
Yes, I agree.
This is great news. And I think it's interesting. It should be noted that they unionized under the CWA, right? The Communication Worker.
The CBWU, which is a little bit of a mouthful, Comic right. Book Workers Union.
But it's under a larger union umbrella because it wouldn't be supported just as a 7 or 8 or 12 member union. So I think it's the CWA that is the larger umbrella with which this falls under. But and it should be noted, these are not the artists or writers or the creatives. These are the actual staff. These are the people who do the, I don't want to say menial labor, because that's not remotely accurate to the situation. But they're the ones that do the real work. They do the real work within the company structure.
Exactly. I pulled this quote from Dave Sheets, who is he's a comic book writer, and I just saw this quote and I thought it kind of summed up how, you know, it summed this up a little really well. It was from an actual comic book writer, and he said, "I sometimes think creators get a little bit too much credit. We write the books and people draw it and all that, but behind the scenes, someone's editing it, someone's color correcting it, someone's designing it, someone's organizing a print schedule, someone's sending it to the printer. There's a million little things I could never do, and I have no idea how to do with this stuff. They should get the credit." And yes. I agree. That's it. Yeah.
Right. And they should get the pay.
Yes. Yes.
And they should be able to collectively bargain for their pay.
Exactly. And just thinking, you know, the whole idea of Image Comics was to get away from that mainstream grind and to give creators more power over their craft. Well, right. They should be leading the way, and apparently they are. Well, it's been a couple decades, but
the initial statement, what has been interesting, of course, is the initial statement by Image Comics ponchos, which was very guarded, shall we say.
Yeah.
And not in support. They were very standoffish about it. I understand that a business has to do that, because at the end of the day, the idea of the union is to be in direct conflict in some ways with the power structure.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be that way, though. They can work in in union with right. each other. It doesn't have to be adversarial all the time. That is one of the problems of our system. I'm not going to go off on a polemic about capitalism.
I think most people figured out our politics by now.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm not going to go off on a polemic about capitalism yet, but the bosses and the workers can work together to make a you know, in a harmonious working environment. The bosses can make a profit. The workers can make a profit. It doesn't have to be at each other's throats all the time. But, you know, I live in a utopian society.
And I think of all the companies for which this would happen first, an image makes sense, again, because of what you alluded to is the initial intent of that company when they first broke, when these creators first broke off.
Exactly.
So, my hope is that, and I think it will be interesting to see, so they broke the ice, and it will be interesting to see how this spreads out amongst other companies. And, you know, I understand that like smaller comic book companies work on a much tighter margin, but will this spread out? Will, you know, the workers at Marvel and DC show an interest in this? Can they show an interest in this because they are both working for much larger corporate entities?
Yeah. Well, that's more
companies.
That will be the real tell here. Because, you know, Marvel and DC both, you can say what you will about either company, they have not been historically good about paying their people.
No.
So we will see. I mean,
but both of their parent entities are used to dealing with unions in their film and television work.
Yes. And Disney, as we all know, is very pro-union. Sarcasm drips from the microphone. Now, granted, they're much better about it than they used to be, but these are still mega corporations, both Warner Brothers and Disney.
Right. And whoever actually owns Warner Brothers doesn't own Warner Brothers anymore. And I, depending on what time of the day it is, who owns DC and Time Warner changes. So I can't keep track of what in this particular hour the owner of Time Warner, DC, et cetera, is.
But in the long run, I think this is a wonderful first step. And, you know, people, especially in the time and the world we are living in right now, people need to have money to take care of themselves. I mean, it's as simple as that.
It's not just money. It's assurances. It's job safety. It's...
Yeah, well, that's, you know...
There are many things that fall under, being unionized that are more than just one's generic paycheck.
Well, yeah, and I mean that. When I say take care of yourself, I mean, to be happy and secure and to know that if you get sick, you're not just going to be removed and replaced.
I think it would also be nice at some point. I doubt this will ever happen, but it would be nice to see a freelancer union as well for the writers and artists and colorists and inkers and all of those who often work basically gig to gig.
Yeah. Well, what would be nice is that people get paid what they are worth and not have to fight for it. But unions, I'm very pro union. I'm a union guy.
Right.
Oddly enough, I'm not in a union because I work for myself, and I would just, the negotiations are terrible between me and myself.
Right. I mean, just it leads to an awkward conversation, perhaps, especially if overheard, through your walls or whatever, someone might think.
Yeah. And I got to admit, I'm a hard ass when it comes to giving being nice to myself. It's just terrible. That being said, I'm happy with this development, and I hope it continues. I hope it expands. And
yeah, I mean, I think it time will tell, and I haven't seen anything myself with things rumbling up from other companies, so it's hard to tell whether this is going to have legs outside of Image or not, but certainly something I and I think you as well will be keeping an eye on.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I hope it, I hope it continues, and I hope it gets better, and I hope it becomes the industry standard.
Right.
All right. That's it. I mean, that was kind of a short topic this particular episode, but I think we'll have a long discussion coming up. So why don't we take a break, and when we return, all hail Mammon.
The swamp, more than merely a place. It is a churning, seething, bubbling bed of life of which you are a part. Once you were a man, a chemist named Ted Salas, until one little experiment went somewhat awry. And you changed. The serum, that was to have made you a super soldier combined with the strange forces in the swamp to make you over into this, a shambling, mindless mockery of your former humanity. The Macabre Man-Thing.
Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you too can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre.
And we're back! Paul, you have recommended what I think we can fairly say is a bit of a challenging comic book to discuss. I have a feeling that you have an intro that you would like to share with us that might be very interesting.
Well, thank you, Brian. Yes, it is a challenge, but here's my best shot. We go to work, we make our money, and for a large portion of the population, we never actually see that money. It gets deposited into an account, and from there, gets distributed to other accounts. To pay rent, to buy groceries, to keep the lights on. And when we want to buy a luxury item, say, for instance, a comic book, we use pieces of plastic or an app on our phone. It's just an exchange of numbers and symbols, a shell game, a sleight of hand, an accounting trick. It's like magic. And when you're really good at manipulating those numbers, call you a financial wizard. In The Black Monday Murders, Jonathan Hickman takes that metaphor to its literal extreme. Soren Kierkegaard once said, when speaking of free will, the human being must always choose between God and mammon. Jonathan Hickman asks, what if that's the same thing? The Black Monday Murders tells the story of an evil cabal of amoral, heartless stockbrokers. Or in other words, stockbrokers. They essentially run a portion of the world by practicing black magic and making periodic sacrifices to a god. The system of magic used to do this is complicated, and the details of their machinations are intricate. So much so that in order to truly understand it, you would need charts, graphs, diagrams outlining the members of the cabal, their relationships, hierarchy, and history. But don't worry, Jonathan Hickman's got you covered. Now, Jonathan Hickman's writing style has always been unique. He uses symbols and almost Kabbalistic-like diagrams to punctuate his stories. But in Black Monday Murders, Hickman actually out-Hickmans himself. In addition to those charts and graphs and diagrams, he utilizes alternate literary techniques like emails, letters, and redacted documents to accentuate the typical panels of words and pictures. The result is a story that is dense and complex, but incredibly rewarding if you pay attention to that devil in the details. Details that are beautifully brought to life by the brilliant art of Tom Coker. It is gorgeous and grotesque, a gritty noir combined with a gruesome horror aesthetic overlaid with a veneer of a Wall Street slick shine. But in the end, despite its intricacies and complications, the story is really just a murder mystery with supernatural overtones, albeit one that hangs its central conceit on economic theory and a critique of capitalism. And Black Monday Murders can be a bit daunting for first-time readers of Hickman's work. And the sheer wealth of information being presented to you can be overwhelming, but the story being told is rich. Its world building is extensive, and with a little patience and persistence, it will reap rewards in the long term. Brian, what did you think of Black Monday Murders?
Well, Paul, heavens to Betsy. I think your intro captured pretty well this comic, and I think what was great about reading this in the way that we're reading it now is, and I think I've said this a million times before, I mean, it's kind of our shtick, right? Is that yeah. a lot of these are comics that we've read in the past.
Yes.
Not always, but in many ways, many times, these are comics that we've read in the past, and we've read them on a month-by-month basis. And for a variety of reasons, have never revisited them in a trade. So again, this is our shtick. And this is like the perfect example, particularly because this comic came out The first four issues came out regularly, right? Month after month.
Yeah, regularly-ish. I think there was some delay in those first four. But.
And then it took another, like, you know, 50 years for the next comics to come out. And it's not over.
Yes, there are still four remaining issues. So we read the first eight.
Eight that have come out. But they came out over such a long period of time. And
I actually lost track of this. I started reading it.
Same.
Yeah, when it first started coming out. And then it just was so long between issues that I lost track of it and didn't read it. So I didn't actually read it again until all eight issues were out. And this is definitely a series that benefits reading in a trade.
Yes. That said, reading it again, I mean, this is a fantastic piece of work. In some ways, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I feel like this had the potential. I don't think it does now because of the delays and because of various other things. This had the potential to be Hickman's kind of, I want to say, magnum opus.
Yeah.
Remember when Nightly News came out and we were like, hey, this kid Hickman, never heard of him before. Image took a chance on this comic. Wow, that's a weird comic. And we were like, this kid might have a future in comics. And yeah. Of course, as we know now, that kid did have a future in comics.
Boy, howdy. I mean, yeah. Jonathan Hickman is...
People are very divided on his career in some ways. There are folks like me probably who are a little more invested in his independent work rather than his corporate work. Although I loved his Fantastic Four
run. I was just thinking that exact same thing. I was like, I don't know. That's pretty damn good run.
I you know, but his Avengers run, it was okay to me. And I have absolutely no idea whatsoever what he's been doing with his X-Men run because I don't follow the X-Men. But people very much like it or very much dislike it. I think Hickman has, his works tend to be love or hate for most people. There's not a lot of apathy in between.
Yeah, that's true. He's one of the masters working today. And his idiosyncrasies, I guess you'd call it, for his charts and graphs. I made several jokes about it already, but I actually love that. I love that about him. Even in the Avengers, just laying out who all the his Avengers run, he would have these little graphs of who's in the story and how they connect to each other. I find that so fascinating. Just as an aside, his X-Men run was fantastic. I remember a few years ago, I said that was one of my favorites of the year back in the day. Now, as is typical for the X-Men, it went from this nice, tight little piece of work and ballooned out into X-Menery.
Because Marvel and DC as well just can't help themselves.
So. Well, they said, hey, this made money. Let's just exploit it to its umpteenth degree.
It is for me with Hickman, reading Hickman, it's the Manhattan Projects, it's the East of West, and the Black Monday murders that are the pieces of work that he does that I really love, as opposed to I enjoyed that. And so I include the Black Monday murders in with East of West and Manhattan Project. But Hickman is certainly an individual. I think he would be a very interesting person to talk to.
Yeah.
Or not at all, because, you know, some writers are better on page than they are in conversation. It's like actors, you know, some of the best actors are blank slates in terms of their personalities. And, you know, I've never been to a signing for Hickman. I've never met him at a convention. So who knows? But the man has a lot going on in his head.
Yeah, it's possible.
Most of those are in terms of graphs and symbols.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's possible that if you have a conversation with him, you'll next see a map of how that conversation went and where all the topics and how they link up.
And I think some of that tends sometimes to be a bit repetitive.
Well, all right. For instance, in this...
He likes circles a lot.
I was going to say, in this particular thing, there's a language. It's kind of a demonic language that's just circles and symbols. Are they the same circles and symbols he's used? Because he's used this circles and symbols in X-Men and in Avengers
in everything.
Yeah, in East of West. Do you think there's like a Hickman verse where everyone uses this language?
I think maybe that's the case. I didn't go back and research and, you know, copy the images and lay them over each other in a, you know, presentation or, you know, but
he didn't carve them into a dead body.
I did do a PowerPoint. And I'm sure there's somebody in a university somewhere right now doing a paper on Jonathan Hickman's symbols.
It's a doctoral thesis.
It's a doctoral thesis.
Anyway, that would, you know, I actually would find that fascinating if everything was in the same universe, including the Fantastic Four and East of West and Black Monday Murders. It all takes place in the Hickman verse.
Yeah.
Why is there not a Netflix series of this particular thing? This seems to be something that would play so well.
Particularly currently.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, there should be a show, like there's a lot of his work that could easily be. But I'm surprised. I think there is there an East of West series in development? I felt like I saw that at some point, but that could have just been a fever dream.
I think East of West is a fever dream.
Well, yeah.
We have a lost episode of East of West, by the way.
Oh yeah.
That was our very first thing we ever recorded together, was an attempt at doing East of West, and we were just not up to the challenge.
It was good that was an attempt versus because we may never have gotten off the ground if that episode had aired.
Listeners, as you know, we tried to start this program with Jonathan Hickman's complicated stuff, and we just said, no, let's start slow and move on. And we haven't done Hickman again until for years later. Look at that.
But to the issue at hand.
Yeah, should we actually talk about the comic? I think we're avoiding it.
I mean, this is a really impressive piece of work. It is. So when you ask, I'm answering your question finally. What did I think of the comic? This is a very impressive piece of work. And again, the art, just out of the park. We'll talk about that later. But it's a frustrating comic. And I like that. I like that it frustrates me. I like that while there are comics that I enjoy that are 22 pages of Biff Bam Pow, there are comics like this that exist out there. And this is in the tradition of, you know, kind of the greats. I'm not putting Black Monday Murders at the same level as Sandman or Watchmen or even Swamp Thing, you know, certain other things. But I think it is in that tradition, where it is a comic book that demands you read carefully.
Yes, you have to pay attention.
And you think when you read. And it is why it's in that tradition of the comics that moved the perception from that's just kid shit to this is a medium where interesting things can be discussed and talked about.
Yeah, the craftsmanship to how this is presented is... I don't have words for it right now. It's just a way that, I don't have words, which is terrible for an audio format, but just everything about it. I mean, yes, the way he works with Coker and the art is just fabulous, but the way the story interweaves with, you know, like I said in the intro, there's documents and emails and letters and little dossiers of all the different characters. It's so well put together. That's part of me reading through this again was just like, oh my God, this is a man who knows his craft so well. And he's using everything, every trick in the book to tell this story.
But aside from the Jonathan Hickman Appreciation Society that we have formed, the comic itself, I mean, this is your recommendation. I feel like you have some points you need to probably lead in the points that you want to discuss. And of course, we'll, as we always do, wander off.
Yes,
as it were. But do you want to kind of bring us into this, not as an intro, but in terms of what struck you the most with this and why you recommended this?
Again, like I said in the intro, the story itself, for all its complications around the central story is just a detective investigating a murder, and then there's this crazy world that he slowly uncovers.
It's a hard-boiled noir.
Exactly. It's a hard, yeah, it's a noir with supernatural overtones. The main character, or the point of view character, The audience point of view character is Detective Theodore Dumas. So we follow Detective Dumas as he is investigating a murder, and it's a ritualistic, demonic style murder. And he has a little bit of a background of some voodoo in his life through his grandmother, I believe it was, or mother.
It was his grandmother.
So he understands a little bit about this other world of magic and weirdness. And he's one of those detective characters that has a little bit more intuitive than everyone else around him.
And he's got some stuff in his past.
He's a hard-boiled detective. I got issues. Yeah. So we follow him as he's trying to figure out this world. And meanwhile, the world he's figuring out is where it gets complicated. And that is that all around the world economies are controlled by a handful of schools, economic schools. Each one has its own rituals. It's black magic.
It's economics is black magic. Even the schools that are represented, and there's numerous of them. They're based on numeric, you know, they're base 6 or base 3 or base 12, right?
Exactly.
So there are numeric aspects to the school, and each sort of person within that is they represent a level of a supernatural level. Within the I want to say the theology or the not it's not theology well it is kind of
oh, it's yeah it's theology. Theology
is not just like God as Christian God.
So there is the God Mammon, who represents wealth, greed, money, basically, who will provide who provides wealth. If you've sacrificed to Mammon, he will provide wealth, and there are rituals that needs to be completed in order for this to work. So there's this cabal of stockbrokers that have to follow these magical, how do I say it? Coven, I guess.
It is kind of a coven.
There's four seats that each member of this coven has to do.
Right. In the school that is the primary interest to this story.
We're following the Western school. Well, yeah, we're following the Western school, which is based in the United States, New York Stock Exchange, and with a little bit of crossover to the Russian school. We're not doing a good job of this. Oh my God.
Well, right. I mean, so
I thought I had it down, but as I start talking about it, apparently I don't.
It's very complex. And I mean, we don't have 6 hours to get into all the complexity. So it's fair for us to try to simplify as much as possible. So what we're looking at, right, Paul, is in current times when this comic is, when it came out, it was 2016, and it's in modern days, there is one of the primary sort of economic schools that run the world is a merger between the Western school of Cana and the Eastern school of Cancrin. And so they merged at one point, and that point is 1985, which becomes important later. So they merged their schools, and within their system, the original system with Cana that existed for 100 plus years was that there were four seats. And those four seats were earth, wind, fire, and water. And those four seats were, one was the stone chair, one was the watcher, one was the ascendant seat, and one was the scales. And each one represented a different thing. So the stone chair was the sacrificial chair. And this becomes important. The stone chair didn't really do anything, right? They just waited to see if they were going to die or not. The watcher was the teacher. They were and the stone chair was earth. The watcher, which was fire, was the teacher. They were the ones that were actively out there building up the future generations of economic geniuses or not. The ascendant seat, which is air, which was the head. They were the voice of Mammon. They were the ones that made the most executive decisions. And then you had the scales, which represented water, which the scales were the ones that that would watch the actual market and gauge the volatility therein.
Yeah, they were the accountants.
Am I getting that right so far?
Yeah, they were the accountants, essentially, the scale.
Right. But there is literally in this comic a scale that the person who has that chair, that demarcation, would actually have a set of scales that they would have to watch. And when the scales become unbalanced,
a sacrifice needs to be made.
A sacrifice needs to be made because there is volatility within the market.
Right.
This is the generic setup of what we are introduced to at the beginning of the comic.
Right. The one more aspect that I think needs to be clarified is you have members of the coven who each one takes a seat.
Right.
And then every few years they shift it. So they're constantly shifting.
Three-year rotation.
They're on a three-year rotation. So if something becomes volatile, if there's going to be a sacrifice needed, and you happen to be sitting in the stone chair, you're the sacrifice.
Right.
So it's chance.
Literally with the devil.
Exactly. You can have all the wealth and all the luxuries in the world and live for hundreds of years. But if you happen to be sitting in the stone chair, when something bad goes down, well, that's the price you pay.
And it is a known price, but these are also based on families. So it's the head of each family, and it's the Ackermans. Initially, it's the Ackermans, the Rothschilds, the Dominics.
Bischoff. Yeah.
And what happens is then, you know, there's a rite of succession. So it's not like if the stone chair, look at the beginning of this comic. So we start this comic during the Great Depression.
The crash of 29.
And so in Ackerman is in the stone chair at this point. So when the crash happens, what happens is that the other three members of the cabal, the Cana cabal, are tasked with, they have to sacrifice. So Ackerman gets sacrificed, but Ackerman has kin. So the idea is that even though is it Peter Ackerman? I don't remember the guy's name. So he has to be sacrificed, but he has kin that will rise up and join the other four in the rotation. Yes. But what happens is, so you have the Great Crash of 1929, and that's where we start off with. What we learn is, so the crash is happening, and there's a whole bunch of folderol.
folderol. Nice.
with this, right, where, like, there's a little bit of, we talked about this beforehand, I'm going to throw it in here. There's a little bit of Department of Truth in this. What happens is, so because they are the god Mammon demands a sacrifice, and we find out later why this all happens, but what also happens is a manipulation of public perception. And so what we think, because we've all seen scenes and we've all read the history of the Great Market Crash of 1929, and we see people flinging themselves out of windows.
We hear the stories of people who just lost everything and they can't take it and they jump out a window.
Jump out of windows during all this. Well, what this comic is telling us is that's not the case. People were flying out of windows to their deaths, but that was on purpose, and they were being thrown out.
Exactly.
And there's this whole talk in this comic about how, again, it's part of the sacrifice.
Well, in order to keep public perception away from, you know, what's really happening, they try to come up with a misinformation campaign. You know, so we are told the story that these people were desperate and they lost everything and they jumped out the window, when in actuality, they were being sacrificed to Mammon in order to bring back harmony to the market again. And that is actually quite brilliant.
All of this is like the first stinking five pages of the comic.
Exactly. And it's actually quite a brilliant way to set it. You know, it throws us in to exactly what's going to happen. These are the consequences. This is how this works. And we're having a little bit of a difficult time kind of describing what the magical, how the whole hierarchy is set up. You know, he literally puts in, you know, academic documents explaining each school.
Right.
You know, in detail.
We're not going to go into all that here because.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's how complicated it is. You can't just explain it in a couple of lines. It's no, here's several paragraphs on how this works.
And later on in the comic, we actually do get to the revelation as to why this has to happen.
The first four issues are fantastic. They're
we
tightly...
could do a whole, Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, they're tightly paced. The mystery of revealing you slowly the information of what's happening as far as the internal politics of what's going on. We're learning the magical rules, and then we find out what the internal politics are for that family and how they're playing by those rules or trying to break the rules as we find out.
And I think so all of that is set up, and it sets up the mystery. It's like, why does this happen? You know, because when I'm first reading this, like, I'm like, Mammon, this is just hoodoo stuff. It's like, it's not really real. We find out later. It's
he's a mean Mammon Jamma. Oh, I'm cutting that joke. That's terrible.
But, you know, I mean, I'm sitting here, I have 3 pages of notes on the first issue alone. And what's interesting is my amount of notes, like, get lesser as we go on, because he tightens things up a little bit.
Well, he builds the world. He lets you know the rules. And he says, okay, this is the framework this is what we're working in. And now here's how the story will play out according to these rules. Yeah, but he builds that world really, really well, I think. It's a lot of information. And I had to flip back a few times to some other pages and go, okay, how exactly does that work? And who exactly is this person?
Right. And 1985 and 1987, those two dates had me going back and forth all over the place. Spoiler alert.
Don't worry about spoilers.
But I think, so he sets all this up. We go back, we see the original Great Market Crash. We have a sacrifice that's made of what's called the Stone Chair. And these are important things to kind of know, but there's so much more going on that at some point I stopped paying attention to who was the chair of war, or whose designation was what, because I couldn't keep track. So we flash forward, right? To a murder.
To a murder, which is happening in modern times, in the 2000s. And so what we eventually find out, it's a pretty grisly looking murder, and it's one of the Ackermans.
One of the Rothschilds.
One of the Rothschilds. I'm sorry. You're right. See, I get so confused with the names and the people. That's right. It's Daniel Rothschild is killed. There's a brother and a sister, Gregoria, which is an interesting name. Gregoria and Daniel, twins, brother and sister, obviously. For reasons we find out later, Gregoria has been removed from the family. She's allowed to keep her power, but not a position. So Daniel holds a position, and he's found murdered in a very ritualistic way and laid out in a very, very esoteric manner. As an aside again, all right, back to my Hickman Appreciation Society. He uses all these ideas, these esoteric ideas like theosophy and hermeticism and Freemasonry, alchemy, you know, and he takes all these ideas, these different ideas, and he merges them all into this one, he twists and combines them. And it's remarkably coherent,
right?
You know, it really, really does work when you see all this information he's given you. It's like, oh yeah, this system is actually solid.
He takes all these conspiracy theories and he combines them into one thing.
It could have been very easy to literally say this is magic and hand wave it and say it's magic that's doing this. But
he could have been QAnon.
Yes. He could have been, but he puts it all together really, really well. I'm just very impressed about how well this works. And then, not only that, we get introduced to other schools of magic that also have very intricate ways that they work. There's a lot of thought that's being put into this.
Yeah, I think that's the problem with trying to cover 8 issues.
I have to, you know, when I recommended this, it was like, oh, it's 8 issues. How hard could that be? Well, we could have just done an entire podcast on that first issue. That's how dense that is.
So I think, like, maybe do we want to just do a generic plot overview? And do you want to do that? Do you want me to do that?
No, I can. No, we can do that. Look, again, I'm trying to keep this, boil this down to just as succinct as possible. So what we get in the modern day, in the 2000s or the 2010s, Daniel Rothschild is killed. We later find out that who killed him was a fellow named Victor Oresko, who is from the Russian school.
The Kankren.
The Kankren school. And there's a murder. Now, I find this, again, I love the way that this is put together. When it's a merger, we often talk about companies eating each other. When these things merge, they literally eat each other. That's how schools get merged. But Victor is trying to have a takeover. It's a violent merger. But in comes Daniel's sister, Gregoria, who tries to take... Might be a werewolf and has a demon familiar, which is...
And a very familiar.
They've gotten to know one another.
Yes.
Really well. It's also, I believe she was the cover of a Duran Duran album at one point.
Also remember that the familiar, so she's Abby here, but when she was, but she also, this familiar existed with Rhea's grandfather, was it Milton? Milton, as Abigail.
So this is,
we're getting ahead of ourselves here because the familiars are a completely different thing and maybe we shouldn't even address the familiars. I don't know. That's another deep dive.
So we come to know that Victor is basically trying to take over the Western school and take the power for himself. In doing so, he kills Daniel Rothschild. His sister then takes his place and she mounts a counterattack.
Daniel Rothschild's sister takes his place. Yeah.
What did I say?
You just said his sister after saying Victor.
Oh, okay.
I'm being a grammar scold.
No, no, you should, because there's a lot of information. So Rhea mounts a counter offensive in order to block Victor.
And it should be noted that Rhea was in exile. She returns and was put back on the board of Cana Cankren at the death of her brother, Daniel, because there was a void that needed filled.
Whew. Yeah. In the course of learning this, we then get flashbacks to the 80s. And there was a crash in the 80s, which kind of shook everything up. It was very much unexpected. And this is when Rhea was removed and sent into exile.
Right. So we were the Cankren and
Cana
merged in 1985.
Yes.
They did their merge and they did it in some hellish landscape underneath the Berlin Wall. And Cankren, of course, is Russia. And so Cankren is Russia, Cana is the US. So, and this is 1985. And then at one point they're saying there is a crash coming.
Now, all the crashes that have ever happened in modern times, 1907, 1929, and so forth and so on, all these were done by Mammon, by the god who required a sacrifice. But we We find out later, which was manipulated by the Rothschilds.
Or was it?
I thought it was. I thought that Rhea and Daniel had...
That's what we're led to believe, right?
Yes.
So we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit in terms of where information is given to us. Now, in the timeline, we are talking correctly. In where the comic gives us this information is a bit down the line. But yeah, it's also Win Ackerman, who may be the most important character in this entire comic.
All right. Again, I'm going to jump ahead. Win Ackerman disappears at one point, and then when he comes back at the end, and there's this big reveal, and I had to go, wait, who is that? I had to flip back. It's like, oh, it's that guy. I felt stupid, because it was like, it's him. Who? Who is it? I don't know who this is.
And if anybody has listened to this podcast this far without being confused, congratulations.
Yeah, again, when you're reading this, it's so engrossing and overwhelming. You know, you get sucked into this whole world. It makes sense at the time. It's just trying to explain it.
Trying to explain it is very difficult because there's a bunch of time jumps.
Yes.
Because everything in this comic is done with a whole bunch of economic theory expositions, some of which, like, I'm not an economist. I'm not an expert. I have a working knowledge of economy. Mm-hmm. That I would like to think is better than average, but I've never studied economics, so outside of being a layman. So it's the way Hickman sets us up, like this is why it's difficult for us to give a straightforward narrative.
Yeah, this comic doesn't fit a straightforward narrative.
Has a straightforward narrative, but you have to read all eight issues and piece it all together.
Yes. And we're still missing four issues, which is going to tie everything up. So, you know, maybe some of these details will make much more sense four issues down the line. And these are long issues too.
Yeah.
They're 45, 50 pages. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the page count gets a little smaller towards the end of it.
Yes.
But what we're dealing with is, to kind of pull ourselves back, right, is at some point, a deal was made in 1985 that had ramifications that follow forward until present day, in which we have, so there was the merger of Kana and Kankren, which followed 2 years later in 1987 by a market crash that they predicted. Now, who did that and who didn't do that? I think it's suggested that one group did it, but because it's Hickman, I'm not convinced until I read the last four issues. So what happened is there was a betrayal in 1985 that led to the Rothschilds being separated, and only one could keep their seat on the board. The other one was sent to exile. At some point, Wynn Ackerman, who was the Ackerman portion of the board, buggered off and disappeared. And so then flash forward to 2016, when the current narrative of this starts. We have Rothschild killed. We have Victor Oresco being clearly the one that killed him, but why is he doing it? Dumas is investigating this, right?
Yes.
And he is having lots of interesting conversations with a whole lot of other supporting characters. There's a Professor Gaddis who is very interesting.
Yeah, who plays a huge part later in the story.
Part towards the end. But what you have is, in essence, at the very basic level, you have a corporation with a whole bunch of like scheming machinations going on between the members of the board and some of the extant folks who are at the periphery. So all of this leads to, ultimately, Victor Oresco making his final move, or there is a challenge. Victor Oresco has been working behind the scenes to basically take over the whole thing. And you have a challenge at the end that involves, again, the familiar. So it's Rhea Roth, the Rothschild, versus Victor Oresco. And in the comic, there's a whole portion where they talk about how one member can challenge another member. There's all these rules. Not going to go into that right now. But what it means is you can have your familiar battle in your place. And the end result is final and it's total.
And in the meantime, while all this is going on in the, you know, the family politics, the school politics is going on, we are following Detective Dumas, or Dumas. and he's slowly piecing these things together and slowly coming to understand what the world is and how the magic works. Mm-hmm. And along with this Professor Gaddis, who he studied this for a long time. He got too deep into it, got scared, and swore he'd never talk about it again. The Detective Dumas kind of coerces him back into it again.
Gaddis wrote a book that was disappeared.
Yeah. Essentially explaining how this all works.
Right. And he was using these symbols again to go back. There's symbols all over the place, and these symbols mean things because they're a language. The symbols are a language.
Interesting thing, because the familiar, only Abby, only speaks in these symbols, and it's not translated for you. Like, typically a comic will give you those little carrots and say translated from the angelic whatever. Hickman doesn't do that. He just says, figure it out from context, or you know, run alongside or get left behind, which I love, by the way. There's no spoon feeding you anything. You know, you follow the story or you don't. So, not following any timeline at all, here's the gist of the story. Back in the 80s, there was a merger between the Kankren school and the Kana school, which allowed for Victor to take full time on the idea of the stone chair. Okay. At that time, Daniel Rothschild betrays his sister and sends her into exile to be able to get more power for himself. So it seems. But what he was actually doing was he was feeling guilty about how much they took advantage of the poor and the weak. And he was going to try to change things in such a way that he could help out the less fortunate. This worked for a time. Victor found out what he was doing and killed him, trying to take more power for himself. Rhea then comes back out of exile. She then takes more power for herself and has every intention of not doing what her brother wanted to do.
We think.
So that kind of brings us up to date. Is that succinct enough?
That's pretty succinct.
Okay. Yeah. Now, when we try to get into the details of that, that's where we've went off for the last 20 minutes going into the weeds.
Things go kablooey.
While all that is happening.
Way, because it just is a testament to how intricate and well done the story is.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is a very rich and dense storytelling, and it is incredibly rewarding to read, as I said in the introduction. This is an incredibly fun read, if by fun you mean being confused. But no, but the world is built, the world and the rules are built so well and so intricate that it immerses you completely in that storytelling. Yeah. So it's not something someone can just tell you about. You have to actually read it. This is such a unique work. I'm just going to leave it at that. So while all this stuff is happening with the internal politics of the cabal, Detective Dumas is doing his investigation and slowly, slowly unearthing the secrets. And it culminates in him and Dr. Gaddis being allowed to enter the underworld and actually meet Mammon.
And this is where the story goes supernatural a little bit.
A little bit? And it also, this is actually, in my mind, this is where it gets to be theological or philosophical. Because up to this point, I mean, the metaphor has not been subtle. You have to sell your soul to the devil in order to become wealthy. And then once you have that wealth, you have to continue to exploit others in order to keep it. You
know? And the payment is always in blood.
Exactly. People have to die for you to stay rich. Again, not a subtle metaphor. It is a serious
the history of money exchange and the history of.
Yes, it is a brutal criticism of capitalism.
Well, not just capitalism.
Not just capitalism.
No, because this has existed long before capitalism. It's the history of acquisition.
Yes, the exploitation of the worker for the bosses.
You know, the most common language in the world ever isn't Mandarin. It's money. It's not money. It's math.
It's math. It's math. Numbers.
It's numbers.
So you have people sacrificing others to save their own position, to increase their own wealth. But when you go to the underworld and Dr. Gaddis is literally in front of a god who is absolutely brilliant looking, by the way, it's a cow head in a suit. It's amazing. The artwork is great in this, but Dr. Gaddis doesn't want wealth. He wants knowledge, and he's willing to sacrifice himself to give knowledge to others.
Which he does.
And that is, it just proves that being selfless actually gets you more than being selfish.
Oh, does it though?
Well, I mean, we still have four issues to find out. At the end of these eight issues, you find Detective Dumas. We find Detective Dumas. Dumas did it again. At the end of the story, you find Detective Dumas sitting with Rhea in her office, and he's confronting her about what's happened. He's a little shaken by, you know, meeting literal gods. And he confesses that he wants it. He wants to be part of this.
Yes.
We don't know what's going to happen after this just yet. But my thinking is he doesn't want to do this for selfish reasons. He's trying to get on the inside to take it down. That's my thought.
And I wonder if, and this is pure speculation, which is what we do.
Yes.
I'm curious as to whether this comic, if it ever really comes out and is finished, whether it sort of moves away from the supernatural into a more earthen realm.
I doubt that. I think it's going
to,
yeah.
It's hard to say, but with the idea that they're bringing Wynn Ackerman, one of the rebels, right? So they're rebels.
Yes.
The two Rothschilds and Wynn Ackerman were the rebels, right? They wanted to change everything. And, you know, we're talking about bringing them back in. Obviously not Daniel. Although who knows with this comic, maybe Daniel will show up.
I think Daniel's quite dead.
Well, but who's dead? what is dead? It's very interesting.
I truly believe this is where I think it's going.
Hickman left us hanging like really badly.
I know. Well, I think
brilliantly, but it's just like it's very frustrating.
Yeah. From what I, you know, this is my thinking. You have Gaddis, who sacrifices himself for the knowledge.
For basically one piece of information.
Yes, but that information will allow Dumas to take down the organization and fulfill what Daniel had wanted to do to begin with. You don't just throw out that Daniel was trying to help the poor and let that drop.
Right.
I really think that's where this is leading.
Yeah. No, I think as well, we should at least, we've danced around it and maybe we said it, but I just want to say it again as succinctly as I can physically do, which maybe isn't possible. The information that Gaddis achieved by sacrificing his life in his conversation with the actual god Mammon, which took place under the Fed, by the way.
Yeah, again, the metaphor isn't subtle.
Right. The information that he sacrificed his life to get was that the 1987 stock market crash was not controlled or seen by Mammon. And Mammon controlled all of the other stock market crashes. He was responsible for all of those, and we can get into why they happen and how it feeds Mammon, or we could just say stock market crashes existed in order to feed Mammon's hunger.
Yeah, that's, I think that's all that needs to be said.
There's a lot, yeah. But Gaddis sacrificed himself to ensure that it was known to Dumas that the 1987 stock market crash was not created by Mammon and was not seen to be coming by Mammon.
This proves that Mammon isn't in complete control.
Right. And there is a reference within that to a, he says there used to be 8 schools. There are 6 now. One was consumed. I assume that means Kankren.
Yes, that was Kankren.
And one is invisible to him. He can't see it.
Yes.
And so that to me is the biggest kicker. That's what we worked up to through this entire 8 issues, is the knowledge that one of the stock market crashes was not controlled by Mammon, and we are led to believe that it is because of the 2 Rothschilds and Wynn Ackerman.
Yes.
And so that is the information that Gaddis sacrificed himself to get. And so I think that is the crux of the next 4 issues.
Right. And that's kind of where I see this headed, is to say that Gaddis sacrificed himself to get the knowledge that Mammon can't see everything, that Mammon isn't completely in control, and Mammon can be defeated. Mammon can be overcome. It's what Kierkegaard said. We choose between God and Mammon. And oh man, in my original introduction, I had so much Kierkegaard. Oof. You're welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I cut all that out. Yeah, I see this as, you know, God, I wish those last 4 issues were out, because we could see where this is ultimately heading. Because I see this as...
And I think it would have to be a 2-parter.
Yeah. No, I see this as an ultimate critique.
This really should be a 2-parter as it is. Listeners are really confused by us right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're confusing each other. No, but I ultimately see this as a serious critique on third stage capitalism, and how instead of embracing selfishness, embracing greed, by embracing social aspects and being kind to one another, the world becomes a better place.
Yeah, but I don't know if these people are kind. I don't know if this is...
But I think the detective is.
Well, we don't know. I mean, it's, to be honest, like, even though Dumas is supposed to be the kind of the
protagonist,
the hero, right? Yeah. He's not really. I mean, he doesn't get near as much, I want to call it screen time.
Yes.
As some of the other characters. And we haven't even talked about a ton of the characters, like the peripheral. We haven't talked about Thomas Dane yet, and maybe we won't. It doesn't matter. You know, but narrative is interesting, because in narrative, we are given this idea that we have the protagonist and the antagonist generically across. And so we're kind of given that Detective Dumas is the protagonist, right?
But, yes.
And that Victor is the antagonist. Generically speaking, we have those two that I think that Hickman's narrative is telling us that these are the protagonist and antagonist, but are they really? So again, it's I think Hickman's game, long game on this is more interesting than just, was Daniel Rothschild and Wynn Ackerman, are they really altruistic? Because they're coming from a point of privilege.
Yes.
And so are they really concerned about the good of all, or are they concerned about a larger economic sort of idea? Are they interested in the idea or the people? And I think they're more interested in the idea than the people.
Well,
that's my take.
Well, that gets into another different, really interesting idea. You know, you had rich folks in the past, robber barons, who just destroyed people's lives, but then later in life would suddenly give out all this money to charity.
Right.
You know, were they doing it because they actually wanted to help people, or because they wanted to make themselves look better? You know, Rockefeller Center wasn't built because Rockefeller just wanted to give the world a beautiful place. No, he was trying to cement his own legacy.
And that's the other thing, is like, is charity really charity for the good of all, or is it charity for legacy? And, you know, but
it is still charity. And if people are helped out by it, does it really matter what the reasons are, as long as something good is coming from it?
But charity, if someone, I don't want to draw this into too many contemporary things, but if you give $5 million to a charity and you're worth $5 billion, yeah. Well, that's me putting a buck in, you know, the Salvation Army bucket or whatever. So it's...
Yeah. If you, you know, if you give $5 million to charity, but you deny your workers to the right to unionize...
Or say you keep them locked up in a building while a tornado is happening, and then they die because they're not allowed to leave their job. You know, it's...
Yeah, put them in a shirt factory and lock all the doors.
I'm just making that up. That's certainly not a thing that has existed recently in the news. That's the great part about this comic, is we don't know.
But it brings up all these ideas that you can start to contemplate. Because it's not it's not a simple black and white issue, even though these issues are in black and white.
Most of the art is in that sepia tone, black and white. Again, can we just say Tom Coker, genius? Wow.
Yes.
Incredible, fantastic, phenomenal art. It's like widescreen art, but not in the way that Wildstorm did, but in a noir. Oh, it's just such good art. Anyway, I digress, but I think you should keep that in. Because I just want to compliment his art every chance I get. I mean, these are, again, it's, I don't pretend to be an expert on economics, but, you know, there's a level of privilege that all of these characters have, and how they react to it Hickman is doing a very interesting job on it. It's not so simple as someone finally got a conscience.
Right.
Because I'm not sure these people have what we think as a conscience in the same way. It's not in the same way we think of a conscience, because they're thinking in a elevated level of power and money. And I think it's very important to remember, like, that whole mathematics discussion in this, which I think is one of the most important parts of this comic, is about mathematics means... you put a number to a thing you have, and that number, as that number goes up, equals power.
And when you put a number to a person, you dehumanize that person, and they become just an asset.
That person, depending on what that number and how many numbers they can make.
Well, yeah.
But an individual is a single number.
Well, it comes down to morality. What do you consider good? If just many of the characters in this comic just feel like if they're doing well, then that's good, you know, and everyone else be damned. If everyone else isn't doing good, if everyone else isn't doing well, then they're not good, you know.
And does Daniel Ackerman or Wynn or Daniel Rothschild and Wynn Ackerman and initially Rhea, whose motivation I'm still not willing to make a judgment on, but as the three who ostensibly rebelled and created the 1987 crash, you know, are they actively giving up their power or wealth?
I don't think they're giving up their power. They want
to. We don't know yet.
Yeah, but they want to keep their power in order to, like, you know, ostensibly, they want to help others by keeping their power.
Yes.
But then you have someone like the counter of that would be Victor Oresco, who just wanted to acquire power for power's sake. He just wanted to be stronger and stronger.
Very clear on that.
Yes, and has no qualms about it. He says straight up, I just want to be the most powerful person in the world. End of story. I want to build rockets and go to space.
You know, I think, but this is what's, this is what I love about this comic is, like, you and I just even talking about this and having a different take a little bit, we're probably closer than
Starman.
But it just, I don't think there are any good people in the story. And we could be proven wrong at some point. I don't think even Gaddis is a good person.
I think he's cowardly, but I think ultimately overcomes that cowardice.
I think we don't know Dumas' motivation yet in any way, shape, or form.
This story has taken so many twists and turns throughout this that I can't say for certain that it's going to turn out the way I think it's going to. But if it doesn't turn out the way that I think it should, I will get very angry about it and complain on.
Well, as you should, because you know it's the part of that's the great thing about a good story is if it subverts your opinions and you're angry about it, it means you're invested in the story and you're invested in the outcome. And if you don't like the outcome, that's different than being apathetic about the outcome.
I'm a fan, and I'm entitled to the story that I expect to be told. Anyway,
I still have 10 pages of notes that we haven't hit yet.
I don't think we're going to get there. I'm sorry. But ultimately, this is just the last few minutes of us talking. That's what this story is about. We spent a good 20 minutes trying to figure out what the actual plot is. Doesn't matter. It's the ideas behind it and the ideas that it brings up. And everyone's going to have their own take on this. And that's a good thing.
Yes.
Because it's going to, ultimately, this comic will spark discussion, the kind we just had.
Right.
And that's fair. And that's what good art does.
Yes.
So I do think this is easily one of the best comics I've read this century, let's say.
It's close to one of my, this is an incredible piece of work. It's as good as Layla Starr. Well, nothing is.
No.
But, you know, I mean, this is up there for me. Mm-hmm. with Hickman's work. Absolutely. I just would really love to see more of this than some of the other work he's been doing lately. And Jonathan Hickman doesn't really give a shit what I think. he's paying his bills.
Yes. He can map out a diagram of how of how less of a shit he gives.
Right. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, he in comics like this, he's creating something that we could spend another 5 hours talking about and bore our listeners to tears with.
Yes.
That is good work.
That is damn good work. And if he lands these last four issues and Coker as well, credit where credit's due. If they can land these last four issues, this will be that magnum opus territory you were talking about. This is really good stuff, even if I can't explain it. All right, let's end it there.
So many with 10 pages of notes left to talk about.
Yeah, no. We didn't even talk about the alternative Catholic or Catholic Church.
We didn't talk. Yeah, there's so much. We could just spend 5 minutes listing all the things. Talk about and not talking about them, just listing that they exist.
The magical system and the world building is impeccably done and just incredibly cool imagery. Oh my God. Just Mammon alone will stick with you.
The coloring, the art, it just.
And again, just how it's structured and the way that the story is told, your standard comic book panels and words, but also documents and letters and emails and phone calls.
Anyone who's ever read Jonathan Hickman knows exactly what he's doing throughout all this.
Yeah. Highly recommended from me.
Yeah. Same as well. I think it's, if people love comics that at all challenge them in any way, shape or form, I think this is a must read.
Absolutely.
And there's nothing wrong if this isn't your bag, or this isn't somebody's cuppa, as the kids say. And that's fine. But
that being said, this was a pretty heavy comic to start the year with. So I'm going to go lowbrow, I think, for my next recommendation.
Well, that seems like a good idea, and possibly...
That being said, Brian, on an all-new edition of the Collected Edition, what do you got for us?
We're going to have a good one. We are going to have a good one, Paul. We're going to follow up this heavy, you know, 20-hour... this heavy 20-hour podcast with one of the comics that exists. Episode of the Collected Edition, we will be discussing the essential mid-80s 4-issue limited series The Beauty and the Beast, written by Ann Nocenti, illustrated by Don Perlin, with covers by the master Bill Sienkiewicz. It's a love story between the Beast and Dazzler.
Yes, which I've been referring to this comic as Bedazzler.
A love story.
It's, I have no words. I'm looking forward to
it. Is this a good comic? No. Only time will tell.
I think this will be a lot of fun to talk about. Let's move on. This is going to be fun, actually.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you still are, that was difficult. but I'd love to hear your comments. So go to our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where you can leave comments on individual episodes, or hit us up on Twitter at Collected Ed Pod. That's Collected EDPOD. I don't know why I said it that way. I think we're a little punch drunk. I'm tired. We're gonna go take a nap. Thanks again for everyone for listening, and keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at @CollectedEdPod. That's Collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Well, Paul, and here's where you cut for a second, just to save you some work later. It's Tom Corker.
Oh, did I say, what did I say?
Corker.
Oh, Corker. All right, I'll fix it.
And I figured, I think you only said it once in your intro.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to be like McScoldy Scold.
No, I misspoke.
I figured you would rather fix that in edit once than many times.
Okay, here's what I'll do. By the brilliant art of Tom Corker. There you go. All right. Magic of editing, it will be.